Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hi, folks, and welcome to Epochs of the Load Seaters number 25, where Beau and I will be discussing what happened after the Battle of Agincourt. And we're going to be talking from post-Agincourt to pre-Joan of Arc. Is that correct?
Yes.
Because then what we're going to do is a follow-up episode where we go from Joan of Arc to how the French eventually won. Boo. Anyway, right. So Henry V has just crushed the French and now is essentially in command of Normandy. Is that correct?
Well, it takes a bit of time before
skipped
that.
Ahead a bit,
we yeah, I mean, we mentioned it a little bit in the last one, didn't we? Just sort of to close off. But yeah, after the great victory in 1415, he has to go after immediately after that. He goes straight back to England because his men are dying still. Yeah. But he doesn't come back the very next year, 1416, just because the money and logistics aren't in place. But he does go back the next year, 1417. Where I think I mentioned it in the last one as well, that France seemed to them kind of empty of French soldiers because Agincourt was such a complete victory.
And so let me, so I assume it's safe to say that basically from his perspective, the sort of campaigning ability of the French was off the table. So essentially the English possessions in France were secure. Because obviously the cities would be garrisoned and fortresses fortified and things like that, and so essentially he had this breathing space to be able to go home and do the sort of administrative work that is required to get 10,000 men out into another country.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, everyone knew that although he couldn't convert Agincourt into just the crown of France immediately, everyone on both sides, it was pretty clear that it was completely decisive, though. It was still a matter of time. I mean, I'm being a bit glib there because things could have gone very badly for him. You could always have bad luck or
could
whatever.
Could have had an accident at sea or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, but things are on rails, right? And you can see when sort of political power is heading in a certain direction. And everyone's like, right, okay, so the French king's just been annihilated, or the Dauphin's been annihilated. Like, there's no one else to stop him, and we're having a severe manpower shortage.
Yeah. I think I likened it to Cannae, in the sense, one of the Romans' worst ever defeats, where it's like their whole aristocratic class was killed that day. Something similar happened at Agincourt, where it's not just some of their important soldiers. It was like nearly everyone that could sort of raise men, like the knightly class, the knightly order. Of course, they weren't all killed, but it was so significant that...
That's the important thing, though, the ability to raise men. Because it's not there's a dearth of like actual men in the country, but there's a dearth of political will. Because it's all very decentralized. And so, like, you'd be expected to turn up with 500 men or something if you're the count of wherever. And these people are all dead. So now they can't do that. It's the feudal organization of French society that's been, severely undermined.
No, absolutely. And the political side of it is, obviously really important. Yeah. And so there's the king, the mad Charles the VI.
Yeah, who thinks he's made of glass.
Yeah. And he's part of the Armagnac or the Valois faction. Or after he dies, they become sometimes get called Dauphinists. So there's still the civil war that Henry V was able to take advantage of. That hasn't stopped. That keeps going to beyond this epoch.
Right,
it still goes on into the age of Joan of Arc
and
beyond. So none of that is over. And so it's sort of like a three-way thing. You've got the English and then you've got the two French factions. And although it's a bit messy, and to be perfectly honest, the real reality is that they switch sides a bit here and there. But mostly you can say the Burgundians and the English are allies against the Armagnacs, or against the crown of France, really. So in 1417, Henry V and his men come back and they basically conquer all of Normandy.
Hmm. And is it the same army? I assume it would be.
Largely. But I don't actually know about that in fantastic detail. Because I don't know if we'd have the roles. of them. But it would be largely the same. Like, a lot of his captains are the same guys, like his brothers.
Why wouldn't he just hire the same guys again?
Yeah, like his brothers are coming. In fact, we should probably introduce some of them now. There's the Duke of Clarence. Mm-hmm. There's John of Bedford, Duke of Bedford. And then there's Gloucester, his youngest brother. And then there's two sisters, one of which died young. And so, yeah, there's like these four boys. And it's interesting, actually, because in history, quite often you'll get like a collection of brothers.
Yeah.
And they end up, well, all killing each other and undermining each other and being just completely paranoid. I'm thinking maybe of Edward IV and his brother Clarence, for example. But then sometimes, much more rarely, they work together. One of the, like the eldest brother is sort of undisputedly... everyone else is loyal to him. I think maybe of Hannibal.
I was exactly thinking of the Lion's Brood there.
Right, and they never try and undermine him or murder him because he's younger brothers. They're always loyal. Yeah. And that's what Henry V enjoys. His younger brothers are completely
and it is
loyal to
enjoys,
him.
Enjoys, because wars between brothers are always bitter and never pleasant.
No, that's it. No, absolutely. But for whatever reason, these four boys, they sort of act in unison. Henry IV, I guess, raised them well enough.
Yeah.
They weren't looking to stab each other in the back all
lucky
the time.
For Henry. So he's got, and I assume they're all fairly competent.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, well, Humphrey of Gloucester, the youngest one, not so much. Right. And we will get into that. We'll have to get into that because it becomes important. But just that campaign of 1417, to move on fairly quickly from that, he takes Rouen, which is the capital of Normandy, and that hadn't been done at any point in the Hundred Years' War. Even Edward I sort of had to bypass it, and so to take Rouen is a massive thing. You can say, even though it might not have been held for all that long, you can say that's sort of one of the high watermarks.
Right. Okay.
When in 1417, when that's taken, and so quite often people think that Henry wins the Battle of Agincourt and then he's just offered Catherine, the princess. But there's, I mean, in the play and in the TV adaptations, it's literally like the next scene.
Yeah, but it's not
but
that
it's
easy.
It's a couple of years later. Yeah, it's a good couple of years later. It's not until
and hard-fought campaigning as well. That's the thing.
Very much so. I mean, it's easy to say, oh, and then he took Rouen. Well, actually, that was...
Taking a city is not easy.
Yeah.
Ever.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, exactly. But he's still taking advantage of this civil war.
Yeah.
The Armagnac and Burgundian civil war. So that's still a big part of it. If it wasn't for that, things would have been very, very different. I mean, very soon after his death, just to jump ahead very slightly quickly, it becomes even more apparent that without the Burgundian help, we would be lost, or it'd be a whole different ball game. It would be way, 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 way harder. It wouldn't really be doable if they didn't, you know, actively help. But again, all that comes up because you can imagine that eventually there, our stay, our welcome has been, we've outlived our welcome there. After the campaigns of 1417, the king, Charles VI, realizes that like the political situation is such that he realizes he does have to sort of face up to the realities after Agincourt.
Yeah.
That being, he's going to have to disinherit his own son, the Dauphin, and marry off his daughter, Catherine, to Henry. And the other part is that as soon as he dies, Henry V will just be king of England and France. But as we know, or as I think we mentioned in the last one, unfortunately, Henry V comes to a sort of a fairly quick end, sort of kind of out of nowhere.
If I recall correctly, he's sieging, was it Mayo?
It's somewhere like that, yeah. And, which is quite a small place.
It wasn't even an important place, but he'd invested it, and then there's a bout of dysentery in the army. He catches dysentery and dies.
It's like, I think, could there be a more ignoble death than dysentery?
I mean, there probably is, but it's not high up on the list of noble deaths, especially for great conqueror kings.
Yeah, it's... There's better ways to go, I think.
Yeah.
I've got one quick quote here from Churchill. He says, "Fortune, which had bestowed upon the king all that could be dreamed of, could not afford to risk her handiwork in a long life." I like Churchill's turn of phrase. It's actually quite interesting. "In the full tide of power and success, he died at the end of August 1422 of a malady contracted in the field, probably dysentery, against which medicine of the times could not make head. When he received the sacrament and heard the penitential psalms, at the words, 'Build thou the walls of Jerusalem,' he spoke, saying, 'Good Lord, thou knowest what my intent has been and yet is, if I might live to re-edify the walls of Jerusalem.' This was his dying thought. He died with his work unfinished. He had once more committed his country to the murderous dynastic war with France. He had been the instrument of the religious and social persecution of the Lollards. Perhaps if he had lived and the normal span of... Perhaps if he had lived the normal span, his power might have become the servant of his virtues and produced the harmonies and tolerances which mankind so often seeks in vain. But death drew his scythe across these prospects. The gleaming king, cut off untimely, went to his tomb amid the lamentations of his people, and the crown passed to his son, an infant 9 months old. End quote. So, yeah, you're left with a tiny baby ruling his minority, this poor doomed Henry VI. Just this tiny boy, as I say, 9 months old, who is, in 2 months' time, when Charles VI, the mad king, dies, this 12-month-old, 10-month, 11-month-old baby is the king of England and France.
Which is something that is totally untenable. And so has created a massive power vacuum in not just one, but two kingdoms.
Yeah. Like, it's one thing to have someone ruling in their minority, but when they're a baby.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
And ruling over two kingdoms.
Yeah.
As a baby.
Yeah, it doesn't bode well.
But it's now, not going to last, is it?
This Henry VI, a good friend of mine, I talk to him about history a lot. We disagree heavily on Henry VI. He's one of the very few figures that I really feel sorry for. And he disagrees. He completely disagrees. He says, you know, he's sort of... all the things that happened to him are of his own making.
Right.
And he hasn't really got anyone to blame apart from himself. Mm-hmm. Well, he made a rod for his own back. That was the turn of phrase I was looking for. Whereas I just feel sorry for him because it does seem that he was simple of mind. And so I have more sympathy for people of those. Right, okay. So he's known as the Mad King.
Right.
Our maddest king. In fact, I was just listening to a thing, historian Nicholas Vincent. I haven't got a quote from it, so I'll have to just be off the top of my head. But he was saying that from... Richard II onwards, all the next few kings have had the accusation of madness levelled against them in one way or another, culminating with Henry VI, who is sort of undeniably mad in adult life a few times.
So do you think this might be a sort of hereditary problem?
Well, it definitely is for Henry VI.
Yeah.
Because he is the grandson of the mad Charles VI.
Right, yeah.
So the madness was passed down through his daughter Catherine, who had a baby, Henry VI, who it's the same type of madness, it seems, as well, where you think you like selective mutism or something. Like Charles VI was known for just sometimes just not responding, just being sort of catatonic. He's perfectly conscious.
Yeah.
And if he's hungry enough, he'll eat and things, but he just won't respond. Just catatonic, really. And Henry VI suffered from that at various times. Okay. He'd sort of come in and out of lucidness, like he would just be essentially catatonic for months on end and then suddenly just be fine again, or say
not,
he is.
Not what you want from the king.
No. A medieval king, that's sort of as bad as it could be, really. But we're only going to talk about, because all that really plays out and gets really, really serious in his adult life and throughout the Wars of the Roses. The idea that Richard II had some sort of maybe mental illness, that he was paranoid, or that Henry IV had some sort of paranoid delusions on some level. Henry V, some have said, is like a religious fundamentalist to the point of being unhinged, some have argued. And then his son, Henry VI, is sort of undeniably a bit mad later in life. Christopher Lee, historian, says, physically, Henry VI was weak. Mentally, he was probably simple. On some occasions, obviously so. He never much changed during his 40 years on the throne. And when he was 50, he was murdered. So that's it in a nutshell. But we're only going to talk about him when he's a little baby.
I suppose, really. Yeah, but oh my goodness.
So sort of the political map and the actual map sort of changes fairly quickly over these few years. So when the old king, Charles, the mad king, Charles VI, died, you can imagine the French Civil War, sort of the aspect of it all, has to change again a bit. The Dauphin, the disinherited Dauphin, now is sort of, in some people's minds, in his own mind, he's the king now.
Well, he's Charles VII of France. Why would he argue anything else?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And what else is he going to argue?
Yeah, you're right.
What are his options there? Of course he's going to be sick. Well, I'm the king. And who else is going to challenge him?
Well, exactly. Well,
the pretender in the Civil War.
Yeah, there's him. Yeah, yeah. So the Duke of Burgundy.
Yeah.
Who is Philip the Good? Is the son of John the Fearless. In the last one, we didn't really talk about much about John the Fearless, but he's an interesting figure.
We haven't, and yeah, I like that the Burgundian dukes get good appellations as well. Yeah, they sound great. You know, John the Fearless, Philip the Good. Oh, that's go on. But we'll, yeah,
if I go down in history, my epithet is the Fearless. I'll be happy with that. Right. I'll take that.
Better than Charles the Bald, or Charles the Mad, or you know, the French kings have got terrible epithets.
Yeah, much more likely to go down as the Bald.
Yeah, I think my favourite though was Louis the Foreigner. What's the most notable thing about him? Well, he comes from somewhere else. Yeah. Like, okay, brilliant.
Doesn't even matter where; it's just foreign.
Yeah, he's just somewhere else. You know?
There's one of the emperors, Philip the Arab.
Yeah.
It's just that we'll just leave it at that.
I mean, at least he gets to come from a discernible place, Arabia. Yeah. You know, Louis the Foreigner, just a foreigner. anyway, sorry.
Philip the Good is sort of the Duke of Burgundy. And as I said earlier, he's sort of the English's ally. Yep. And sort of he has to be. Without his help, things would be way more tenuous.
But then I suppose conversely for the Burgundians, without the English assistance, things would go worse for them too.
That's true. No, absolutely. Yeah, we saved their bacon one time here quite quickly.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.